Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Town Talk, financed by Deakin Wealth Management, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. John Hennessy with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here this morning. Lots to cover. We'll get into as we go along this morning about the weekend events with the Battle of Fredericksburg. But John, good morning. Been way too long since you've been in.
Ted Schubel, a lot's happened in the world. A lot's happened on the hockey rink. Well, really, not much for either of our teams right now.
Although the Red Wings aren't making the playoffs, but there's at least a little bit of hope maybe for the future.
Well, the Penguins are supposed to make the playoffs, and they're not. And so this is going to be a pretty depressing show for people.
We won't talk much hockey this morning because I looked at the points this morning and I thought this is nothing we can. Either one of us can revel in. Before we get going with some of the other things, former President Bush and the funeral today and it taking place, you've done several shows. The Park Service has done programs. We've done shows and talked about presidents in Fredericksburg. President Bush was in Fredericksburg at least the one time I know. I remember, and I think it was 92, he was down, he spoke in front of Gulrich's and went to Fredericksburg Hardware, and he was in Fredericksburg along with a number of other presidents over the years.
Yeah, he was here in September 1992 at the height of the election cycle, and he gave a little speech on tax policy, and I'm sure it was very stirring on Caroline Street in front of Gulrich's, but he had the newspaper estimated between 3,000 and 5,000 people there.
I was there. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was a very policy kind of oriented speech.
Well, as we've often said in the past, Fredericksburg's big enough to attract presidents and occasionally famous people, but small enough to get really excited when they come.
Yeah.
It's not an everyday sort of thing. And even today when, we have a candidate come to town, it's a big deal. Most of the time lately, it's been in connection with Mary Washington. Mary Washington has hosted the candidates as they've come through, but it used to be that they were on the streets, and George Bush was on the streets. It was a uneventful trip, but he is one of, by my count, 30 presidents.
30?
Who have visited Fredericksburg. Now, not all of them came while in office. 13 of them have come with while in office, but I suspect there aren't towns of this size anywhere else that have that intense concentration of presidential personas as Fredericksburg has had here over the years. Now, some of it has to do, especially prior to the onset of flying, has to do with the only railroad south out of Fredericksburg, out of Washington, the main railroad south, headed south through Fredericksburg eventually. So some of those stops were rather brief whistle stops with a brief speech on the platform down at the train station. But many of them had purpose and meaning and were well documented by the local newspapers. And every single one of them greeted excitedly by the people of Fredericksburg, because Fredericksburgers get excited about presidents coming.
Well, the steps where Lincoln supposedly spoke from are over in front of the Fredericksburg Area Museum now.
Yeah, they were they'd become damaged over the years. Originally on the side entrance to the bank building, the former National Bank building, before that Farmers Bank, now Foodie. Mm-hmm. And when the new developer of that building realized that they could not be used, he offered them to the Fredericksburg Area Museum. And now it's interesting when there's a new phenomenon. I guess it's not new, but we've certainly noticed it at the park, that photography for proms and homecomings is just this huge thing. Chatham has been discovered as a venue for proms and homecomings. And we get hundreds, some spring weekends, we get literally hundreds and hundreds of cars coming to Chatham filled with teenagers and their parents wanting to take pictures. Well, the Lincoln Steps just outside the museum have also been discovered by prom goers and homecoming folks.
That would be a great spot.
Yeah, and there's a, you know, every fall weekend when there's a homecoming locally or in the spring, there's a throng of young people getting their picture taken on the steps, which, you know, is really kind of neat. They may not dwell on the fact that those steps have, you know, received the feet likely of Abraham Lincoln and others, but they're aware enough of it that it matters enough to them that they want to get their picture taken. So that's kind of a neat sort of thing. And I think exactly when the museum accepted those steps, exactly what the museum hoped to achieve with them.
It is a great spot, and every time you kind of look at them. And
how many places can you go and stand exactly where you know someone like Lincoln stood? And that's just not a very common thing. And even if you only reflect on it for a few seconds, it's kind of a cool thing to experience.
Yeah, yeah. So now Lincoln came through here a number. Now he came through, like, I guess he was at Aquia Landing.
Yes.
At least once.
Well, Lincoln came to Stafford multiple times. Some of the times, at least a couple of times, he just anchored off of Aquia Landing and met with his generals up there. But he also ventured into the interior of Stafford County several times, most notably twice. Once when he came to Chatham, which is where my headquarters are, part of the National Park, and spent a day meandering around this region in May of 1862. There were no Confederates around. There was no battle about to be fought or anything like that. But he spent some time at Chatham at midday, and then later he had dinner there in the dining room at Chatham. And then he crossed the river and meandered through town. And what's really kind of interesting about that trip is that he stopped at the bank building, what is today Foodie, and met with – that was the headquarters of the occupying troops of Fredericksburg at the time, met with Union General there. And then he left, and we didn't realize until a few years ago, he left and actually drove west out George Street to Hanover, out Hanover, across the canal ditch and up into the sunken road. And Lincoln was actually in the sunken road about 6 months prior to the Battle of Fredericksburg. And up on Marie's Heights, visiting Union camps on Marie's Heights, where the National Cemetery is, where Trench Hill is, where the Alumni Center, Jepson Alumni Center is. So he meandered through the camps up there. It's the only place where we know where Lincoln was on a battlefield before it was a battlefield. And it's kind of fun to contemplate as he was getting the reports of the dire Union disaster at Fredericksburg in December of 1862. He knew something about the landscape, and it was the only place that he would receive those reports having some familiarity with the landscape the battle was taking place on. So kind of an interesting little tidbit there.
Very, very interesting. So I guess some of the early presidents, I guess, you know, Washington, who grew up here, and Jefferson, who wasn't far away, and Monroe, and all of some, we would have had some of the early presidents just because this was in the neighborhood.
Sure, sure. And, you know, and some of the buildings that are associated with them are still there. Chatham, for example, we know that Washington and Jefferson both visited Chatham, as did Lincoln.
There can't be another building in this country, or not many, that have had as many either presidents or just people of that stature that Chatham does.
Well, certainly not outside of D.C., or maybe Philadelphia has some. But in terms of private residences, we believe that Chatham is the only private residence in America that Washington and Lincoln crossed the threshold. Now, Lincoln and Washington both visited Berkeley Plantation down on the James River, the Harrison family home, but we don't believe that Lincoln ever went inside Berkeley Plantation. So we believe Chatham has a distinct status that way. But, you know, the town itself, it's just hard to, I doubt there's a town, certainly not of similar size, that has ever seen the steady flow of presidents and future presidents and even occasionally past presidents coming through the town. Some of the visits were really forgettable, some of them quite memorable, although short. I think one of the most memorable ones was when Eisenhower came here in 1954, gave a 123-word speech. If you can imagine giving 123, that would make for a pretty short Ted Schubel program.
Yeah.
We covered that about in the first minute and a half. 123-word speech at the Mary Washington Monument, the grave, out beyond Kenmore.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about that visit was that he was under threat of assassination here. And the Secret Service had mobilized because someone apparently had uttered a threat against the president on the street the night before. And remember, 1954 was not long after the assault on the by Puerto Rican nationalists on the Blair House
yeah.
when Truman was there earlier that decade. So there was a high level of tenseness that surrounded Eisenhower's visit. Although it was very brief, just a matter of minutes, came in, swooped in, gave his 127 or 123rd three-word speech, and then zoomed out of town. I think he was on site for a total of 18 minutes or something like that. So Fredericksburg doesn't always get him for long, but they get him a lot.
We need to take a break. We'll continue this when we come back. John Hennessy, Chief Historian, Chief of Interpretation with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here this morning. Town Talk powered by Stafford Tourism. For information on events and activities, visit tourstaffordva.com. More on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Opinions, we've all got them, and we'd like to hear yours on Town Talk. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
John Hennessy with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here this morning. We were going to talk about the Battle of Fredericksburg and some events going on, and 156 years ago at this time, things were getting ready to take place with the Battle of Fredericksburg. As far as the anniversaries go, I mean, just the anniversary of the Battle of Fredericksburg, we observe it. But any anniversary, I guess, I've noticed over in recent years, a big deal has been made about a lot of these anniversaries.
Yeah. Well, you know, even during the war, soldiers noted the anniversary of significant events. They noted the anniversaries of their enlistments, which obviously changed the trajectory of their lives. But they very rarely failed to notice the anniversaries, for example, of a battle, if they had been in that battle the year before. And so, over time, and as years passed, it's interesting. Originally, the phenomenon of anniversaries was something that largely played out in the press. You know, the newspapers
sure.
10, 15 years after the war would do an article or send someone to visit the battlefields and say, this is what they look like today. Very popular sorts of columns and articles that would often go out on what was the 19th century equivalent of the wire services, copied extensively across the country. But, you know, it's those sorts of visits, which often coincided with the anniversary, that allows us to really understand how these fields evolved and developed over the years. You know, for example, the sunken road at Fredericksburg was pretty much dismantled. The stone walls along the road were pretty much dismantled. And we know that happened within a couple years of the end of the war, because of souvenir seekers, but because local people were looking for building material. And so the stone walls that we so cherish today, well, two segments of them have been reconstructed, one by in the 1930s, one more recently in 2004. And there's only one section of the wall, well, two sections of the wall that still survive today that at least seem to be original. And then it evolved from the kind of press's observation or noting of an anniversary into something more physical and tangible. And you begin to see that really early in the 20th century. And then that begins to accelerate. I think the anniversaries, and in fact, in many ways, the battlefields themselves in Virginia assumed a prominence in local culture with the kind of rise in prominence of Douglas Southall Freeman, who was, of course, a newspaper editor in Richmond, but also became the biographer of Robert E. Lee, George Washington, and wrote the great book, which is still a wonderful read, if scholarly not up to date, Lee's Lieutenants, the great chronicler of the Army in Northern Virginia. And it's amazing when, even in our park files, almost everything the park did in its early years was subject to kind of the imprimatur of Douglas Southall Freeman. We have tons of very short letters, usually, not always, but letters in our collection, in our files from Freeman, you know, commenting on this or that or whatever. But, you know, for the park's purposes, the onset of a formal event here started in the late 1980s. With the observance of the Battle of Fredericksburg, and it has become a tradition. Now, it's evolved in the last few years away from, it used to be a very predictable sort of thing where, you know, we'd have a speaker, we'd have a stand, we'd have reenactors, people would come out, we'd present the colors, we'd play some wreaths, we'd have a speech given, we'd play taps, and people would clap, and usually it was very effective, depending on how good the speech was.
And how cold it was.
And how cold it was. Yeah, you're right. At Fredericksburg, that's the big thing. But a formal ceremony. And last year, we decided to do something different, and we're going to reprise that this year in a different, simpler sort of way because we don't have as much staff, and that is to do something of a remembrance walk, which is a kind of a procession through the Sunken Road area. Beth Parnitza, one of our fine young historians, who is, by the way, about to leave us to become the chief of interpretation at Appomattox Courthouse National Historical Park, a great big step up for her and a great move by that park to get a very talented individual. She's going to lead this year's event on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. So we're excited about that. But, you know, anniversaries, time, and the proximity of time matters to people. People feel closer to an event on its anniversary. They'll stop, they'll reflect on it. It's always amazed me, and I know it's amazed you because you've been at many of them. During the 150th, we'd sometimes get up at 4:30 in the morning to be on site at the moment that something happened, you know, 150 years before, and we'd have 150 people along with us.
Or you've got people from all over the country, from
coming.
California, Iowa, Ohio,
For that reason, for that proximity of time and just kind of the matching the atmospherics of a moment all those years ago. I think the best anniversary story that I have, and I've told this to you before, but perhaps not everybody's heard it, was in 1996, in May of 1996, someone had figured out that the celestial arrangement in May 2nd, 1996 would be exactly what it was on May 2nd, 1863, the night that Stonewall Jackson was mortally wounded at Chancellorsville. The stars, phase of the moon, everything would be exactly as it was. I don't know how they figured that sort of thing out, but in any event, we just decided, okay, well, that's kind of cool, so we'll make it possible if people want to be out there, we'll be out there. So, you know, Frank O'Reilly and I was just support. He was supposed to do the whole thing. We announced we would do a program, a walk there that evening on May 2nd, 1996, and I drove out. Was supposed to start at 7. I got there about 6:30, and there was no place to park. And the people just kept coming.
Yeah.
And by the end of the evening, there were more than 400 people, some of whom had driven 10 hours that day to be on that site that night under the same atmospheric conditions. And in fact, the weather matched perfectly. Everything was perfect that night. And many of them stuck around until the literal minute of anniversary, which Jackson was shot at about 9 o'clock, 1863 time, which with daylight savings time, of course, is 10 o'clock. And then people responded to the reality that in the 1880s, the nation went to standardized time, which caused an adjustment of clocks by 11 minutes. So to get exactly right, when daylight savings time is in effect, you have to go one hour and 11 minutes different. And so we stayed out there till 11 minutes after 10, and we had about 100 people who hung around. We were only, the program only went till 8 or 8:15. We had people stick around for almost another 2 hours just to be there on that spot under those conditions. So the power of that proximity of time and the simple atmospherics, it affects people. And so they want to be on these places at the time or about the time that these events happened all those years ago.
Well, I remember it was at the end of I think it was a week after the 150th for Fredericksburg, and you did it on a Saturday. And there was a guy there, and I remember him. I don't know if he was telling you or telling someone I was standing next to that. I think he was from Ohio, and he said that his wife that he'd been saving up for years, and she had said, "You go."
Yeah.
And he had spent a week here,
right?
Going to all the programs, and then this program was a week after all the formal programs you had done.
Well, for the 150th of Fredericksburg, it was kind of front end loaded because the way the weekends fell. So our heaviest stuff was on December 9th and 10th, and I don't know how many people told me that they came for the big events on December 9th and 10th, the procession through the streets and the tolling of the bells and all that stuff, spectacular stuff. They came for that and then decided they were going to stay the whole week and do the minute-to-minute, the real-time sorts of events that we did all that week long. It was really amazing and a very vivid lesson of how anxious people can be or how much they want to get close to these events and understand them and on some level feel them in a way that is meaningful to them. And so anniversaries have emerged into something that are almost, for some people, very spiritual. And, you know, our purpose is to give them an opportunity to be at these places at a time that matters to them. And so we do programs.
Battle of it was the anniversary of the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse a year later. I mean, it was a bus driver from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and for 2 years she had saved. She was a bus driver.
Wow.
She had worked it out with her school system because that was in May, that she could have those days off because she had a relative who died here.
Wow!
And she wanted to be here for the anniversary.
So that's you're a Michigander too. So there's an example of a feeling Michigander, which we're not accustomed to.
Well, no, which would have been when I told you the story, you were surprised. But yeah, no, so it is. The anniversaries do matter to a lot of people.
They do.
When we come back, I want to talk about, I found a terrific Facebook page link because of you yesterday, and I want to talk to you about that, about just letters and what we learn from letters, too. John Hennessy, Chief Historian of the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here this morning. 156th anniversary of the Battle of Fredericksburg this weekend. We'll have all the details before we get out of here this morning. Town Talk, financed by Deakin Wealth Management, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. More on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 8:32.
I had the radio on. I'm listening to
Talk Done Right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. Got a question for today's guest? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Town Talk powered by Stafford Tourism. For information on events and activities, visit tourstaffordva.com. John Hennessy with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here this morning. You, John, yesterday on Facebook introduced me to a terrific Facebook page that talks pictures and letters from people. But I was telling you off air just now, what really struck me, and you all read letter or you read excerpts from letters all the time. That's what makes I think a lot of these programs so meaningful, because you're hearing from the people. But this Facebook page, for the first time, I was reading letters from a soldier in Falmouth and also looking at him.
Yeah.
And that was pretty powerful.
Yeah. So this one of the phenomenons that we're witnessing now, there's two things going on. One is kind of crowdsourcing source material, and especially transcribing source material. It's pretty interesting. You know, when I'm getting old now. I'm about to enter my seventh decade of life, as a matter of fact.
I have heard. I heard Friday's there's like a number
that.
Of.
Well, we don't need to announce that on the airwaves.
Okay.
But, you know, I grew up, you know, digging around archives and reading really hard to read script and things like that. But more and more, I think we're seeing an expectation on the part of people doing research, or at least a hope that everything's been transcribed. And so a lot of institutions are crowdsourcing, are putting the word out, if you'd like to take a shot at transcribing this letter or that letter, help us do it. And so there's a lot of that going on right now. But one of the most remarkable sites that I've seen on Facebook or on the internet, he has a Facebook page as well. It's not a Facebook site. Is a site called Spared and Shared. A guy named Griff, that's all I know. He's not from this part of the world. What he does, or what he's been doing for quite a long time, is to contact the owners or the dealers, oftentimes, who are selling letters and diaries online, or people contact him too, I think, and offering stuff. And he transcribes them and posts them. But what he does is he also puts in a tremendous effort to find out as much as he can about the people who are writing these letters. And he puts them online. And it's an astonishing sight, because of the volume. The man clearly wakes up in the morning, starts transcribing, and transcribes until he falls asleep at his keyboard at night. Because every day, literally every day, he's posting stuff that he has transcribed online. And it's all beautiful. I mean, he pays attention to design. He uses graphics beautifully. It is a pleasure to use his site. It's called Spared and Shared. He has a Facebook page called Spared and Shared. But more than that, it is for someone like me, or really anyone who just wants to take a dive into primary source material. Boy, this is just a treasure trove of stuff. Hundreds, thousands of letters he has transcribed over the years. And some of them are just individual letters from individual soldiers or civilians. Others are whole groups, wartime runs of letters, a whole collection from the soldier or between the members of a family. And that's really kind of one of the things that makes this particularly valuable, is wherever he can, he gets both the outgoing letter home from the soldier, which are typically preserved, but a surprising amount of time, he also has the incoming letters from home, from the wife or the mother or the family at home, and he writes about them. Yesterday on his Facebook page, he put up a letter from a soldier relating his encounter with a local woman. And the soldier wrote, "The old lady of the house had a queer idea of the war. She claimed that if someone of the rebel army would kill Jeff Davis and someone of the Yankee army would kill Lincoln, why then she thought there would be nobody to set the men fighting each other." And that's a sentiment you often hear, that really, you hear it in almost every war. If you left it up to the soldiers, peace would be at hand. They would figure it out. No one's actually ever tried that in the history of the world, so far as we know, except maybe for the Christmas truce in World War One in 1914. But so these letters are just a treasure trove. If you know, I think people get intimidated by source material sometimes because, hey, there's so much of it. But he has a tremendous eye, and he's done us all a great favor by really applying this idea that for something to be easy to consume, it also has to be nice to look at and well organized. And so he pays a lot of attention to that. And so not only are there the letters here, but there's the story of the people here. And it really is a unique site in our business, one that is growing, and it is saving. And what I like about it as a historian is when these letter collections go on sale on eBay or wherever they go on sale, oftentimes when they're purchased, they disappear.
Right.
They're no
you
longer
never
available.
See them.
Well, no longer available to researchers or scholars. So he is saving them for scholarly use. It'll be interesting to see how we manage a site like his going forward, because we don't know how long digital data is going to last. We know paper will last for centuries, but we don't know how long digital data will last. So, so we worked out an agreement with him I talked to him about our exchange emails, and I said, do you mind if we save the stuff that's relevant to our area to the files at the park? And we are doing that. But that by itself is a big job, because there's dozens and dozens of letters that he's come up with. And really some new stuff, some feeling stuff.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Just the other day, he posted a letter written by a soldier who was part of the expedition that was sent out from Washington about a month after the Battle of the Wilderness to gather up the remaining wounded who were still on the field 30 days after the battle. And the soldier describes not only that experience of gathering up these wounded, but the battlefields themselves. And so there's something that comes up on his page almost every day. And his Facebook page doesn't post everything that he does, but it gives you a good sense of it. So if you're on Facebook, the search for Spared and Shared. If you're not on Facebook, just Google Spared and Shared Civil War Letters, and you'll go right to the site and just have a little fun exploring. It's really remarkable.
This is it, because what you do just continues to change, and you think, well, history's history. It's the same. Dave Morocco had the talk of what they keep discovering at Ferry Farm, and this is the same kind of thing.
Well, Ferry Farm, as we see it today, is the product of a process of discovery that has been going on since George Washington died. And so we've learned a lot at Ferry Farm and elsewhere, but we're always learning more, always. And if it's not a new fact, it's a new kind of viewpoint on an event or a person or a place. And that's the stuff that, as public historians, we love. So, we'll take these accounts, we'll take the best of what's written, and we'll incorporate them into the programs that we give to people. And I agree with you. One of the reasons that our staff is so successful at reaching the public is because we use the words of the people who are here as much as we possibly can.
I remember early 80s when I came to this area, of how I think of how just even the story was told at Chancellorsville, 'cause I think that was the first place I went, and just how it was the battle, the army was here, it moved here, the information. And now, like you say, just whether it's from diaries or whether that room out in Chancellorsville, I think next to the Vietnam Wall, is one of the great treasures we have, because you can go in there, I can go in there, I could stand in there for a half hour and just go look at from picture to picture to picture. And you see picture, you're looking through time.
That room that you speak of, we call it the memorial room. It's not a formal memorial, but it is a room in which just the photographs of men and civilians and women who were affected by the events in our park, the four battles here, it's their photographs and just very brief 30, 40 word stories of what happened to them. And the idea for that room was begotten by Andrea Decoder, who used to be on our staff, is now the chief historian at Richmond. And she said, well, let's just create a quiet space. And we did. And amidst all the high thinking and big words and the important words in the main exhibit, this simple quiet space is by far the most effective space that we have in either of our two visitor centers. So if you haven't been to the visitor center at Chancellorsville within the last few years, and even if you don't particularly like exhibits in a traditional form, go to this space because it is different. It's just the faces of the people who were here and a little bit of information about what they experienced while they were here. Also on the wall is the names of all the known men we know who fell in the four battles here, more than 17,000 names.
That's the other thing.
On the wall.
Yeah.
And so it's that space has been a huge success. It really has.
Town Talk, financed by Deakin Wealth Management, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. John Hennessy, Chief Historian and Chief of Interpretation with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here. When we come back, we'll wrap it up by talking about what's taking place this weekend. A number of things are taking place, some good stuff. Even though it'll be a little bit cold, it will be worth your while, and we'll talk about it when we wrap it up on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. Miss an episode of Town Talk? No problem. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Music. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
John Hennessy here this morning, the Chief Historian, Chief of Interpretation with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. It's the 156th anniversary of the Battle of Fredericksburg. Doesn't seem like 6 years since the really big observance that you had. But a lot going on this weekend, all good stuff. And this area, 156 years ago, I guess at this point, the Union Army was over by Chatham, waiting to cross the river at this point.
The Union Army had moved into Stafford County, and in fact, their camp spread from essentially what is the I-95 interchange at Route 17, mm-hmm. You know, where Target is and all that stuff, north to Stafford Courthouse and beyond, and then east all the way to Passapatanzi and down to the river. So over the course of the next 8 months, from November until June of 1863, the Union Army would be here, and their presence would constitute the greatest disaster that Stafford County has ever seen. Not an episode of wanton, intentional destruction, but the presence of more than 120 or 100,000 troops on this landscape here transformed the landscape in ways that it would take Stafford County decades to recover from that. But yes, they were here. They were on campaign, and they were hoping to move. They had intended to cross the Rappahannock quickly when they arrived here on November 18th, but their pontoon bridges did not arrive until about a week later.
And what were the great what ifs? What if they had gotten across and we would... It would be just there may not even have been a story.
Right. We may not be here today talking about any of this. There may not be a national park here because of that. But the fact is that they didn't get across before the Confederates arrived here. And by the time the Yankees were able to cross, the Confederates were here. And so Burnside would spend the better part of a couple of weeks trying to figure out what to do next. He ultimately decided that the most surprising thing he could do would be the most obvious thing to do, and that is to cross right into Fredericksburg, cross right into the waiting arms, mm-hmm. hostile waiting arms of the Confederate Army, if you will. And indeed, Lee was somewhat surprised by that, but in ultimately a happy sort of way for him. And he assembled the troops, the Confederate troops, on the heights west and south of town, and setting the stage for the attempt of the Union Army to cross the river on December 11th, 1862.
You've got programs this Saturday at 9 over at you're leading a program at Chatham,
right,
that will talk about
talk
the crossing.
About the crossing. It will view the event from the perspective of that thousands of Union soldiers who were able to watch this happen a very dramatic event that involved the laying of the pontoon bridges, which was a difficult, dangerous, bloody exercise on the part of the Union Army. The bombardment of the town, which attempted to quell the Confederate resistance to the crossing. And then finally, the successful crossing late in the afternoon. So at 9 o'clock on Saturday at Chatham, we're going to take about an hour to walk some of that ground. And for me, the excitement about this part of that program is that we will spend some time on the road, on the ancient road trace, which still exists but has never been really seen by anybody, on the ancient road that the Union Army used to get the pontoon boats down to the river from the heights at Chatham. So we'll spend some time there, and then we'll walk around past Chatham, the building itself, and out onto the heights overlooking the pontoon crossing. We'll spend about 60 minutes there until about 10, and then for those of you who are hardy, we'll pass off to Frank O'Reilly, who will gather a half hour later at the upper pontoon crossing at the foot of Hawk Street at Sophia, and he will lead a 90-minute walk that talks about the first urban combat in American history. And if you've never been on a program with Frank O'Reilly, it is a profound treat to be on such a program. And so he'll do that starting at 10:30. And then in the afternoon, Greg Mertz, who runs our programs day to day and doesn't get out nearly enough to give programs, but is just outstanding at it, he will lead a program at 2 that looks at the fighting on the south end of the battlefield at Prospect Hill. So a full day, essentially, of activities, of hiking, of learning, of reflecting, all of those things on Saturday. And then Sunday, of course, we will have the annual walk in the footsteps of the Irish Brigade, which Frank again will leaves at City Dock at 11:30. And follows the footsteps of the Irish Brigade, by far the most famous aspect of the Battle of Fredericksburg, the one that received immense attention at the time and continues to receive immense attention. And then at 2 o'clock, Elizabeth Beth Parnitza of our staff will lead the Remembrance Walk along the Sunken Road at Fredericksburg.
Like you said, I mean, this was a profound time. It was, you mentioned about the damage in Stafford County, the damage from the war and what happened 156 years ago in the city. This is still visible
in
a lot of places.
And, you know, because Fredericksburg was something like Gettysburg, a battle of panoramas, the sight lines were immense, especially from, you know, the Union troops on Stafford Heights around Chatham and up around Falmouth, they could see clearly across the river. And because of that, they knew exactly what they were getting into, and they knew what they were getting into was bad, really bad. And so there is an aspect of this battle that entails foreboding that is more profound and dark, really, than that of most other battles. This anticipation that these men were going into a place that many of them would not come out of. And so there was nothing spontaneous about it. It was planned, and it was foreshadowed. And the men knew all this, and yet still they came. And the reason we're here is hopefully that people will reflect on the reason why. Why did they agree to do this? What was so important to them that they would go into such a place as Fredericksburg?
John Hennessy, Chief Historian, Chief of Interpretation with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. Thank you, John. See you soon.
Ted.
That is it. We will see you tomorrow on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own, and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.